ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF store and sponsored by iShares. iShares sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. iShares is not affiliated with the ETF store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show this week. As always, I want to thank iShares, the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime. We have about 3 weeks left in 2020, and there is a little bit of drama unfolding in ETF land. ETFs are actually nearing their annual inflow record, new money into ETFs. Now, it's going to be close, but if you think about this, if we go back to March or April, I'm not sure many people would have bet that we'd even be sitting here in early December with a chance to break the ETF inflow record. But here we are, and in just a moment, I'll be joined by ETF.com's Drew Voros. We're going to spend a few minutes discussing this, talking about some of the drivers here. And if you look, November in particular was a monster month for ETFs, just blew away past records. So we'll cover that. And then it's also been a very busy year for new ETF launches. They did slow down a bit during the corona crash and immediately following that, but they've picked it up big time since then. By my count, we've had about 270 new ETFs come to market this year. And I thought it'd be fun if Drew and I just batted around some of these. We'll look at which new ETFs have found success. I want to get his favorite new ETF, trends he's seeing with new launches, and I will find out what he thinks is the best new ETF ticker symbol as well. I'll then be joined by one of my favorite guests that comes on this podcast, George Milling Stanley, Chief Gold Strategist at State Street Global Advisors. Of course, State Street offers the world's most popular physical gold ETF. And I would say few in the world are as knowledgeable as George on gold. So we're going to talk gold prices, gold ETFs. And if you know the history of George and I discussing gold and other potential stores of value, you already know we're going to talk Bitcoin as well. And then to close this week, another fantastic guest, I'll be joined by Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETFs, who they crossed over $1 billion in assets earlier this year. They're now at about $1.3 billion. And of course, I think most ETF investors know Shark Tank's Kevin O'Leary is involved with O'Shares. He's chairman. But O'Shares has had one of the better performing ETFs this year. They're global internet giants ETFs. So Connor's going to highlight that. And then we'll also just discuss the economy and markets overall, including what Connor thinks the post-COVID world is going to look like and how investors may want to position around that. As always, questions or comments, you know where to find me, out on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. Or you can go to ETFprime.com. Let's chat with ETF.com's editor-in-chief, Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling a private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, thanks for joining me this week. Only a few weeks left here in 2020, which is sort of hard to believe.
Thanks for having me, Nate. Always a pleasure to be on. The years just go quicker and quicker.
All right, so I'm going to put you right on the spot, right off the bat here. Will ETFs break their annual inflow record this year?
I think so, and I think it'll be easy, and I think it'll be before Christmas. We've just seen just a monster month in November, some $91 billion in new assets coming into the space. And then we saw the first few days in December also take inflows. So the momentum is clearly there, and there's really no reason to see why people would be pulling back. And, in fact, December is usually one of the strongest months of the year, as we see a lot of money go into ETFs across the board, fixed income, equity, as people are rebalancing and setting the table for the next year.
Talk a little bit more about what we saw in November, because from my perspective, obviously it was a full risk-on environment, right? We had news of the vaccines, and I think just removing some of the uncertainty around the presidential election and the transition. And so because of that, we saw stocks hit record highs, and I don't think it's any surprise investors were putting new money to work. But even given that, stock ETF inflows in particular, as you touched on, I mean, they blew away their past record. It wasn't even close. What did you make of that?
What I made of it was a big shift into equity. And we saw $61 billion go into U.S. equity ETFs in November. That is just a monster number. And a lot of it came as we saw 10-year yields rise before the election. And as yields rise, prices and bonds fall. And so we saw a lot of outflows in bond ETFs. And in fact, the top outflows in November were littered with mid and long-term treasury funds that really took the brunt of the hit when we saw the 10-year yield rise. So we saw this big move into stocks, and why not? Every day it seems a new all-time high is being reached. And so take the money out of what's not working in terms of fixed income potentially, and we're also expected to see higher rates as we go into the Biden administration, and equity just keeps rolling along. And we saw it across the board. We saw it in mid-cap. We saw it in small-cap, all of which are performing. And, of course, the bulk of it went into big, large-cap S&P 500 index funds. So very healthy market and going into December. I just don't see why it would slow down. And when you look at the numbers in November, something like almost three to four billion a day was coming into the ETF space and new assets. So just do the math. I think we'll be there before Christmas.
What's interesting is that the flows into stock ETFs in particular are in stark contrast to what we're seeing in active mutual funds, active stock mutual funds. And I know it's always easy for people like us covering the ETF space to say, see, this is more evidence the world is shifting to ETFs, right? Mutual funds are dinosaurs. They're going to go extinct. And I think in response to that, some people would say, well, you know, Nate and Drew, you guys are ETF cheerleaders, right? Your jobs depend on ETFs to a certain degree, so you're biased. But when I look at this data, the data is the data. And I think it's very telling that in a year like the one we've had where stocks were down nearly 35% at one point, ETFs may set a new record in terms of investor money. Is there any reason to believe mutual funds will stage some sort of comeback over the next few years?
Well, a couple things. One, we're not cheerleaders, as you know. We're as hard on the industry as we are when we salute it. So I think what we're seeing here is just years and years of innovation finally coming together. And it's not so much investors moving to ETFs. I really think it's the wealth managers moving to ETFs. They're creating their own ETFs. They're bringing assets into their own ETFs. So it's just a big, huge fundamental shift in the industry. Not so much an investor wants. And investors now know, compared to 10 years ago, what an ETF is, sort of what the advantage is. And mutual funds are going to be around for a long time because there's so much retirement money in mutual funds. They just can't pull that out without the capital gains being realized. So mutual funds will be around, and we're starting to see that slow worm turn in the mutual fund industry toward ETFs from some of the big companies. We saw American Century come in this year with its own with the biggest active manage launch this year. So slowly they'll be coming in, but there's just so much money in mutual funds, it's just not going to leave. It's going to be there for a couple more decades.
It is amazing, though. You mentioned some of the old guard mutual fund companies getting involved in the space. I mentioned last week, it feels like ETF growth may actually be accelerating, which here we are now almost 30 years after the first ETF came to market. And to feel like we could see growth take another, you know, leap forward is pretty remarkable. Okay, so you mentioned innovation. Let's talk 2020 ETF launches. And I'm sure over the next few weeks, we'll be doing several recaps and whatnot and looking ahead to 2021. But there have been about 270 new ETFs this year. And so I thought it'd be fun just to talk about some of these. And again, really, it has been a tremendous year for ETF innovation. Again, I know, whatever, we're cheerleaders, but what stood out to you this year with new launches? You can just take this wherever.
Sure. Well, what stands out to me is diversity in the issuers. So, you know, we always talk about the concentration in the ETF market around assets and the big three, Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street. But if you really look at the top launches this year, it's a spread between big issuers and mid and new issuers. J.P. Morgan had the top launch in terms of new assets this year with J.P. Morgan Beta Builder U.S. Mid-Cap Equity, BBMC. That's just another piece of the puzzle that they've been building for their clients. The Beta Builders are a suite of index-based equity products covering large, mid, as we just talked about, and also international. So they're really building out a suite of ETFs to offer to their clients in every capacity that ETFs offer. But then again, you also have we've seen more and more of these defined income ETFs come out. So we had FTCBO Vest, the U.S. Equity Deep Buffer ETF, DFEB, which is a February timed cycle. But these are defined income ETFs that allow protection on the ups, on the downside, as you give up some on the upside. And we saw this from Innovator. We've seen it from Trumark. So we're seeing more of these defined income ETFs that are a real risk management tool. And they're not coming from BlackRock, and they're not coming from Vanguard. They're coming from smaller issuers. So I think that's what's impressive to me is with J.P. Morgan, you're seeing smaller issuers come out with innovative products that are meeting the needs of investors.
No, I completely agree with that. Now, I guess that said, if you look at the top five ETFs this year in terms of assets, you mentioned BBMC, which is at the top of the leaderboard. Number two is the iShares 0 to 3 month Treasury Bond ETF, ticker symbol SGOV, SGOV. Number three is the Xtrackers MSCI, I'm gonna butcher this, Kokusei Equity ETF, KU. And then number four, iShares ESG MSCI EM Leaders ETF, LDEM. And then fifth is the Cabana Target Drawdown 10 ETF, ticker TDSC. What's interesting to me about all of those, I believe every one of those has a component of bring your own assets, right? So we know BBMC with JP Morgan, that's some internal money. I saw something, actually, I think it was at ETF.com, that SGOV, the bulk of that came from Boston Private Wealth, which is an advisory firm. The Xtrackers ETF, I saw a substantial portion of those assets came from one institutional investor, Nisei Asset Management. And then the iShares ESG ETF, we know that there's been quite a bit of bring your own assets there. And then the Cabana Target Drawdown ETF, that was a conversion of a separately managed account strategy. What does it say to you that you look at the top five ETFs on the leaderboard this year in terms of new launches and assets going into those, and they all have a component of bring your own assets?
Well, those assets are coming from clients that those issuers already had or likely had. And so what they're doing is just offering the product that they would have offered in a different wrapper, but they're offering it in the ETF. And you can see the diversity here. We're talking with KOKU, the Xtracker fund you just mentioned, it is screening out Japan when it comes to developed equities. So it's kind of an odd thought. If you think about it, you're going to take developed countries, but you're going to screen out Japan. But as you said, there is a client that wants that, and the way that they found the best way to offer that is through an ETF wrapper. likewise with SGOV, a pretty simple iShares 0 to 3 month Treasury bond fund. But again, obviously with somebody that wants that as a client, a big client in BlackRock, they designed an ETF, I presume, with them in mind, mm-hmm. and others will take advantage of it as well. So I think what we're just seeing, as I mentioned before, the real shift here is issuers and wealth managers using ETFs as the go-to tool for their clients, and that's just becoming ubiquitous across from small houses to mid to the biggest wealth managers in the world.
I mentioned there's been about 270 new ETFs this year. In your opinion, what's been the most surprising new launch? And I guess I'll define that as most surprising by assets, just the success it's had.
Well, I'll point to one that's a little smaller, but it's out of the top 20. It's number 20 for a couple reasons. So it's the Round Hill Sports Betting and iGaming ETF. That's BETZ. Two things I find interesting. This is organic retail money. And since June, when it launched, it's taken in about $160 million in assets. And when you start comparing it to SPY that has, you know, almost a quarter or a third of $1 trillion in it, you know, $100 million starts looking small, but that's not small in any measure. And it's also tapping into a market that is very ripe and, frankly, very young. Sports betting has always been a black market activity. Now it has become more and more part of certain states in terms of taxation and legitimacy, and people are going to it through apps. So we're seeing sports betting become much like lottery. People are going to have it at their fingertips, and gambling is just what people do. People want to bet on football games. People bet on the stock market. People bet on the lottery. So I think they tapped into something that the retail market understands, and we're actually getting in on the ground floor there. And Round Hill has basically grown this in the retail space, which is real difficult to do. As you know, Nate.
Well, and you also have to give Round Hill credit. When they launched this ETF, there weren't a whole lot of sports being played at the time because of the pandemic. And they launched into that environment and you know, clearly have had a lot of success. I guess speaking of the pandemic-inspired launches, which I think you could probably lump the sports betting ETF into, to me, the biggest surprises this year have been the Global X Telemedicine and Digital Health ETF, EDOC. That has nearly $500 million. And then the Direction Work From Home ETF, WFH, that has over 150 mil. And I think the reason for that is when I saw these ETFs launch, initially they just felt a little gimmicky to me, that they were just capitalizing on the current environment that we're in. But both of those have found a pretty good audience. And, of course, Global X has been a machine with some of these thematic ETF launches. So those, to me, were probably the most surprising this year. Drew, I'm curious, not a recommendation, but do you have a personal favorite new ETF this year?
I would stick with BETS. I think it's a smart idea. I think it's really a ground floor ETF, and I'm surprised there haven't been more copycats. And I think you're going to see that space grow and grow, especially in terms of the pandemic. Not so much people sitting at home betting, but going physically into casinos, going physically into card rooms. Those things are going to go away. Slowly, just like we're unfortunately seeing with restaurants. The physical contact scarring that people are going to have is going to last for a while. And that's why I think those work from home and the Teladoc ETF are interesting, because I think those are two trends that are not going to go away when the vaccine comes out or when we get over this hump of people not going into work. People have found that they can work from home. They enjoy working from home. And we've seen a lot of people physically move, and companies allow people to leave the state to work from home. And I also think with medicine, it is very efficient for a healthcare provider to offer telemedicine. I'm sure some of us have gone through using telemedicine over the last year. It is very efficient. There's no waiting rooms. You're being seen for things that, you know, maybe you don't need to go all the way into an office to do. So I think those are going to resonate, and I think those are going to last, and I think investors see that.
Well, you and I are on the same page in terms of favorite new ETF, because I agree. The sports betting and iGaming ETF from Round Hill, I looked through all these ETFs over the weekend. I think that one stands out to me. That has to be my favorite. I've talked about a sports betting ETF for a couple of years now, and the pushback was always the universe was too small. There you know, weren't enough investable companies there. But again, that space, to your point, regulations are changing. The laws are changing, and this looks like a space that could have some success, and clearly some investors are jumping in here early. Just about a minute left. Give me your favorite new ETF ticker symbol this year.
Well, this is easy for me. It jumped out at me when I saw it was launching. It's the Direction Moonshot Innovators ETF, ticker Moon.
That's a good one.
The reason I like that, I am a graduate of Moon High School in Western Pennsylvania. And people think that's odd, but there was also a Mars High School in Western Pennsylvania. So that is mine. Moon is something, it's an interesting fund as well. It's an innovator fund that's looking at moonshot companies. So it's not a space ETF. It's looking at early stage innovative companies. They exclude mega caps. Its top holding right now is NIO, which is an electric vehicle maker in China that has just gone bonkers this year in terms of its stock. But it's really sort of clean energy. It's also Virgin Galactic Holdings. It does have a certain amount of space thought to it, but it also has CrowdStrike, which is a very monitors the web and allows different tools to be used on the web. So it's very broad in sense of next gen, and I think the ticker is an easy sell in terms of having people remember that.
I thought Moon was great. Obviously, Bets, which we've talked about. What stood out to me is RISN, R-I-S-N. That's the Inspire Tactical Balanced ESG ETF. I thought that was pretty good. There's been a few other good ones this year. Germ, the ETFMG Treatments, Testing, and Advancements ETF. Deed, which is the First Trust TWC Securitize Plus ETF. SPAC, right? I would say overall, this was probably a down year for ETF tickers compared to some of the past years, but there's always a few good ones on the board. Drew, we'll have to leave it there. Always appreciate the time. Fun stuff this week. Thank you.
Thank you, Nate, for having me.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. My next guest is George Milling Stanley, Chief Gold Strategist at State Street Global Advisors, who is currently the third largest ETF issuer, 141 ETFs, about $830 billion invested. And of course, they offer the most popular physically backed gold ETF in the world, the Spider Gold Shares, ticker GLD. They also offer the Spider Gold Mini Shares, ticker GLDM. And George is now on the line with me from New York. George, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Nate. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
All right, so in looking at GLD, it's pretty mind-boggling. This ETF has grown from about $43, $44 billion in assets at the beginning of the year to $70 billion now. It's currently one of the 10 largest ETFs. Now, of course, you helped pioneer this ETF back in 2004. I'm just curious, what's it been like for you watching this ETF grow to such a size?
It's been incredibly rewarding. I think that you know, when we set out to before we even got GLD launched, when I was working for the World Gold Council, the sponsor, we basically set out to try to take some of the perceived friction out of investing in gold. You know, people could buy bars or coins, or they could buy futures or get an indirect exposure by buying gold mining company stock in various different ways. But all of them, most people perceive them as being barriers to an easy investment in gold. So we really wanted to democratize gold investment, make it available for every investor. And here we are, as you say, just over $70 billion later. I think we can call ourselves a success as far as GLD is concerned.
You look this year, we have seen record flows into gold ETFs as a whole. I'm curious, do you think they're sustainable? Or maybe another way to frame this is, how big can these ETFs actually get?
I don't know that there's actually a limit on how big these ETFs can get. You know, there's something like $150 billion or so globally in gold-backed ETFs. And I think the last time I did the calculation, there's about $9.5 trillion worth of gold that's been mined since the dawn of history. So we really haven't made much of a dent in that market as of yet. But, you know, as I say, every journey starts with one little step. And I think that's what GLD has been. The whole move toward gold-backed ETFs, I think, has, as I say, been extremely encouraging that people clearly want these products. I think there's plenty of upside to go. Whether we can maintain the incredible inflows that we've seen into the whole universe of gold ETFs or even just into GLD, with GLD being up $16 billion year to date. I don't know whether we can sustain those levels, but there certainly is no upper limit. And I'm definitely seeing continued growth in the inflows in 2021. The problems that have prompted people to invest in gold are not going to go away anytime soon. And I think that you know, there's definitely a future out there for gold ETFs.
Well, and obviously a big determinant in terms of those inflows is going to be what the price of gold does. And I guess on that note, let's talk more about the gold market. It's been interesting. So I checked yesterday, GLD is up about 22% on the year, still outpacing the S&P 500, but it is down from where it was back in August. GLD had been up about 36%. And I do want to talk about that full year-to-date performance, but what have you seen here just over the past couple of months? Why has there been a little bit of weakness in the shorter term?
Well, you know, first week of August, the news on the COVID front was just uniformly bad. We were starting to move into this new renewed phase, which is now breaking records daily, whether it's records in terms of new infections or whether it's unfortunately records in terms of deaths, but we do seem to be setting a lot of records. So the need for a safe haven was paramount in investor minds, and I think that that we got some speculative activity drawn in by the extraordinary momentum that the gold price developed earlier in the summer. So we set a fresh all-time high somewhere around the 2070 mark in the first week of August. And I think that that was perhaps a little rich, perhaps not sustainable at that point. As I say, a little bit of speculative froth had crept in. So we've seen some profit taking. I think we've seen some speculative long liquidation out of GLD, out of gold in general. And I think that that's probably healthy. We're still up, what, $340 year to date. That even if we stayed here until the end of December, that's still a tremendous performance, up $340, 22%, as you say. And I don't think we're going to stay here. I think that the news continues to be bad. We, around about November time, round about the election time, we got apparent resolution of the presidential election. We're still awaiting resolution of the outcome in the Senate because of those runoffs down in Georgia. And we also got really optimistic news on the vaccines. The realities of the vaccine, difficulties of distribution, people not knowing how long immunity actually lasts, how rapidly it's going to get to the general population, how quickly we're going to get to the 80% immunized that we need in order to get to herd immunity. There's a lot of questions about that right now. And I think that, the worries are still there. It's going to take us a long time before we finally say goodbye to COVID-19. It isn't going to happen overnight just because we have some vaccines on the move. So we're going to be well into 2021, is my guess, and possibly even longer than that, before we can really start to let our guard down, throw away our masks and so forth. So plenty of worries out there. I'm not seeing any fall off in gold investment at all. As I say, just a little bit of speculative profit taking is what we've seen in the last couple of months, but I don't expect that to continue, and I don't expect it to last.
That's really well said. And actually, I want to talk just a little bit more about that full year performance from gold. You mentioned maybe there was a little bit of froth here over the past couple of months, but you look and gold is still up over 20% on the year. Talk more about what we've seen from gold in 2020, because from my perspective, this year has really highlighted the potential value of gold. I feel like we've seen a full market cycle condensed into a few months, but you look at gold, it's held pretty steady throughout the year and of course, shown some strength as well, despite the chaos that we've seen everywhere. Can you talk more about that?
It's interesting when you talk about that condensing of time periods. I think COVID-19 has messed with all of our heads in many, many ways, one of which is it's screwed up my sense of time. The old joke about every day being Blur's Day when you're working from home. I don't know whether a lot of time has passed or whether it's all shot by in what seems like nanoseconds. But you're right. I think that gold has done exactly what it's supposed to do during 2020 when we got the big drop in equities in March. Gold went down briefly as people, faced unexpected needs for liquidity. Especially people who'd bought equities on margin were faced with calls for additional margin, with the values of their holdings having dropped precipitately, 30% or so. Those who were savvy enough to own some gold were able to sell some or even all of their holdings in order to meet those margin calls, meet those liquidity needs. And then once the liquidity crunch passed, they tend, history has shown, they tended to buy back their gold holdings as quickly as they could because it had done exactly the reason they bought it for. So that's what we saw back in March, gold coming to the rescue of investors when they didn't want to sell their equity holdings at depressed levels. And since then, you know, the fact that we are still up 22% in spite of a significant pullback from that fresh all-time high set in the first week of August, I think it's a tremendous performance by gold, even, as I said, at these levels. So it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. There are so many anxieties out there. COVID has obviously just made everything worse. But, you know, people are concerned at the possibility that with now renewed lockdowns coming into force in this country, or even some states locking down for the first time, mask mandates coming from people that I never thought would actually approve them, even though obviously masks make sense. So COVID has just made everything worse. People are concerned about the possibility of another recession. We were in recession the first half of this year. Moody's Analytics has posed the possibility that we may fall into recession again in the first half of next year because of the impact of not dealing adequately with COVID. So that's a problem. The potential for a second downward leg in the equity market, maybe not as big as we saw in March, but because that was just a big shock on just how seriously we needed to take COVID. But the potential for a second downward leg in equities is there. That's worrying investors. And, of course, debt. You know, people were concerned a year ago that we were $23 trillion in debt, and it was looking like it was going to go up $1 trillion a year. Well, we're about $27 trillion in debt now, and it's got up already about $4 trillion this year. So we're in a much, much more difficult position there. So the economic news, not good at all at this point. There were some signs of recovery potential in the third quarter of this year. I'm worried about what fourth quarter numbers are going to look like, given the way that the virus seems to have swept over the whole of the United States again, even when we thought we dealt with it in certain areas. So plenty of reasons for investors to want safe havens. Gold has thousands of years of a track record of offering some protection against the unexpected, whether your tail risk is macroeconomic or geopolitical. And that's exactly what gold's done in 2020.
So, George, as I listen to you go through that, there are a lot of potential drivers of gold that I hear as you walk through, you know, what's currently going on. If you had to boil this down for investors, what are maybe, you know, two or three potential drivers that you're watching, that you think investors should be watching moving forward?
There are two things that I think are very, very specific that I'm keeping an eye on. And if investors want to keep their finger on the pulse of what gold's likely to do, they would be well advised to do the same. The first one is that we seem to be making a pretty poor fist of dealing with COVID-19 in this country. As I say, with people having either not locked down at all, now facing the problems of not dealing with the virus then, and so we have to deal with it now, or of having locked down and then reopened a little too early. So I think that, you know, we are still facing major problems on that front. That means there's going to, and the same across Western Europe, not just in the U.S. here. So I think that means there's going to be no reduction in the demand for safe havens, no reduction in the demand for gold as an investment, especially in ETF form, because it is very convenient. So that's one trend I'm looking at, our continued failure to deal adequately with COVID-19. The second thing that I'm looking at, the emerging markets led by China, they were the first into the problems of the vaccine, the first to go into very strict lockdowns, very strict mask mandates, which it's more in their nature anyway to wear masks, even if they just have a sniffle. But they've taken the virus much more seriously than we did in the West. And I think that they're reaping the benefits of that now. China is one of the very few countries that the IMF expects to have positive economic growth this year. It's looking as if any recurrences of the virus tend to be rather localized and therefore relatively easy to contain. So it's looking as if the emerging markets will have some economic success in the remainder of 2020 and through 2021. They've kind of gotten the jump ahead of the rest of the world. If I'm right on that, then the emerging markets will begin to feel more prosperous and to rely on that prosperity. that means that they will go back and buy more gold jewelry, which is what they tend to do when they're feeling prosperous. Gold jewelry, as you know, was hammered in the earlier part of this year with the world on lockdown of one degree or another. If we get a rebound in gold jewelry demand, along with continued safe haven buying in the West, that, I think, is then going to be a serious recipe for higher gold prices through 2021.
All right, George, with our remaining time, I want to make sure we get to your favorite topic, Bitcoin. Of course, you and I have discussed this topic plenty in the past, and I thought I might try to approach this from a little bit of a different angle this time. As good of a year as gold is having, Bitcoin is now up about 170% year to date. And I do feel like I'm seeing more investors calling Bitcoin digital gold or gold 2.0. And it does seem like the primary use case for Bitcoin is circling around it being a digital store of value. Now, with a caveat that I'm going to give you plenty of opportunity to discuss what you don't like about Bitcoin, what do you see as some similarities between Bitcoin and gold? Because I have to think at least, surely you see a few commonalities here.
With all due respect, I think this is probably an issue that you and I are never going to come to agreement on. So I'm glad that you keep bringing it up because it does give me the opportunity to rehearse my opinion. My opinion is changing in some respects. Let's just say this. There are a number of eminent institutions, I'll just mention two of them, Fidelity and JP Morgan, that have in recent months have started to write about cryptocurrencies in general. Obviously, Bitcoin being the leader takes a big slice of that. They've started to write about it in terms of asking the question whether cryptocurrencies can ever become, not saying that they already are, but can ever become a strategic asset. I think that a lot of what these research publications tend to do is they'll define a strategic asset, they'll write about what cryptocurrencies have done, but they don't quite tie the knot of saying that means that the cryptocurrencies have become a major strategic asset. And most of them have steered clear of saying whether they think the cryptos are going to rival gold as a strategic asset, which I think is very wise of them. Otherwise, they would have people like me on their tail. So I think that there are institutions starting to take it more seriously. I am still not taking it more seriously as a strategic asset because of the volatility. People complain about gold being volatile. Look at what the cryptos have done, even in just the 12 years of their existence. They are many times more volatile than gold has been. One of the things I think, again, another interesting development, so you can see that I'm watching the space, Nate, very carefully, perhaps following your example a little bit, that knowing you take these seriously, I take you seriously, so maybe I should start to take them more seriously too. There are a number of governments and central banks around the world. I think China is the only one that has actually gone public, but there are a number of governments who are wondering whether government-issued cryptocurrencies might be the next logical development in the monetary system. We replaced cowrie shells and wampum with gold coins and silver coins. We replaced the gold coins and silver coins with greenbacks and copper coins. We have, to a large extent, replaced those with computer digital information stored on computers. Digital currencies might well be the logical next step for governments to take. But that, I think, will take away a lot of the attractions of the cryptos for the people who are currently investing in them, because one of the things they like best is the fact that there is no government control. If governments are issuing cryptocurrencies in their own right, I think it might take away some of the interest of the privately issued cryptos out there. We might well see government-issued cryptocurrencies. I think that is another possible development. So there may well be a future out there. I'm not so sure the future is going to be for Bitcoin or for the private ones, but for digital money, yeah, I think there's a possibility of a future there.
Well, George, let me ask you this. Do you have any view on why Bitcoin has moved so much this year? Again, up about 170%.
I could be unkind here and say far too many day traders with far too much time on their hands, mate. I think that's obviously got to be one possibility. As I say, I'm not hearing from the financial advisors that I talk to or from the end user investors that I talk to, and I'm on the phone just about all day, every day these days. I'm not hearing from them anybody saying, let's take this seriously. What they're asking me what my view is. They're saying it looks like Fidelity and JP Morgan may be taking it more seriously, or the Chinese government may be taking crypto's issues more seriously. Should we be doing the same? Nobody, I think, has actually taken the decision to go ahead and do that. I've not seen any evidence from any of the investors that I talk to of a shift away from gold and into cryptocurrencies, or even into cryptocurrencies alongside gold. Financial advisors very wisely are asking questions about them, I think in the same way that the big institutions are asking questions. But I think these are still questions. I'm not seeing the answers as of yet. Until I do, then, I don't really have an explanation. I think, as I say, I think that to me, the cryptos still tend to be something of a casino chip. I think that investments do tend to develop momentum, and that then day traders and speculators will get behind them, just as they got behind gold in July and early August. Then I think from time to time they'll get behind the cryptos. But, we've seen the cryptos lose 80% of their value in one calendar year just a couple of years back. I'm concerned that we may be lining up for yet another crash in a similar kind of order of magnitude.
George, one thing I hear with both gold and Bitcoin is that they're both reliant on the so-called greater fool theory, right? That, I don't know, gold is just a pet rock and Bitcoin is vaporware, and they both rely on somebody simply paying a higher price for them. How would you respond to that?
I would say that what you've just done is you've summarized the way that a tactical investor or a speculator in gold might be thinking about gold. But I think you know well that I've always seen gold really coming into its own as a strategic long-term holding. I think that gold gives you returns. It has given you capital appreciation on a compound annual growth rate basis since Richard Nixon created the free market in gold back in 1971 when he closed the gold window to foreign central banks. You've seen a capital appreciation on average of 7.75% per year. That's not too shabby for this asset that people say doesn't have a yield. Gold does not have a strong statistical relationship with anything else in a typical portfolio, so it's giving you a level of diversification unmatched by probably any other asset. And the final one, and I think this is also in a way, it's a nail in the coffin of the cryptos, gold has thousands of years of a track record of offering some protection against the unexpected, whether that's macroeconomic or geopolitical. And I think all of those are the reasons why people own gold. They are not reasons why people own the cryptos.
Well, George, I think that is the perfect ending note. I'm going to let you have the final word here this week on gold. It is always a pleasure. I absolutely love our conversations. Thank you very much for joining me this week.
Nate, it's always fun to disagree with somebody that I respect as much as I respect you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. That was George Milling Stanley, Chief Gold Strategist at State Street Global Advisors. I'm now joined by Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETFs, who currently offers four ETFs, about $1.3 billion invested. They actually crossed over the $1 billion mark earlier this year, and that includes one of the best performing ETFs of 2020, the O'Shares Global Internet Giants ETF, ticker symbol OGIG, which we will be discussing this week. Connor is now on the line with me from Montreal. Connor, great having you back on the podcast.
Hey, good morning. Great to be with you.
All right, so let's jump right in on OGIG, and then we can certainly talk broader markets and in the economy. As of yesterday, OGIG is up nearly 100%. So for comparison, I look at something like the Qs, which are up about 45%. And I want to talk about that performance, but I guess first, talk about what this ETF holds.
Yeah, OGIG holds companies that are large caps, selected because they're in the right sectors, meaning e-commerce and internet services related sectors. and scored for quality of balance sheet, quality of profitability, and then a revenue growth rate, including the forward revenue growth rate using analyst estimates. And what we found is that the stocks that have strong revenue growth historically over the last 10 years in all these sectors are the ones that have outperformed. And so that's why we made revenue growth such an influential characteristic of the index and the portfolio in this ETF.
And so as I look at top holdings here, we have Amazon, Alibaba, Alphabet, Tencent, Facebook, Microsoft, some of the largest tech companies in the world. And in terms of that performance, you know, I think many investors are aware of the broader story here, which is essentially that the trends that were probably going to play out over the next several years, regardless, have been accelerated by the coronavirus pandemic, right? And we're seeing these larger tech companies really benefit from things like work from home and online purchases and streaming and those sorts of things. Is the story here with performance that simple, or do you think there's more to it?
I think there's a lot more to it. You know, you just mentioned a set of names that many people do know, and those are the largest holdings in a variety of technology-oriented portfolios. The way OGIG works, those positions are capped, so it's not a market cap-weighted portfolio. Stocks cannot be more than 6% of weighting at each quarterly reconstitution date. And so what you'll find is if you keep going down the list, you'll see stronger performance in stocks that are what we call mid-sized giants. They have new services and lots of room to grow, whether they're in entertainment or cloud services or food delivery or other digitally driven services. And those are the ones that people don't know of yet, and they're starting to become well-known because they're growing so fast, performing so well. Many of those are the ones that are driving the performance that you referred to as being ballpark 100% year-to-date. It's not the Amazon, Google, Facebooks that are up 100% year-to-date. It's all the rest of them that are driving that performance. It's nice to have the mega giants in there. We're quite happy, of course, to have the mid-sized giants in there because that's where the extra performance is coming from.
Whether we're talking about the mega giants or some of the smaller companies here in this ETF, do you have any thoughts on valuations across this space? Because if these trends have been accelerated due to the pandemic, I think some investors would make the case, well, maybe we've also pulled forward future returns and the opportunities moving forward may not be quite as attractive. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we do. And so there are really no smaller companies in here, smaller than the mega giants, yes, but they're all large cap stocks. So there are no mid-cap and small-cap stocks in there. But let's talk about your question on valuations. So we do agree with the comments that are out there that so much has been pulled forward. Revenue growth has been accelerated. But think of a couple of things. Online sales in the U.S. market, so retail sales that are basically processed online, have a very small market share. Last year, something like 16% when you exclude autos. And yes, that's increased tremendously. It's hardly going to go backwards. It's going to, going to continue to increase. And e-commerce is just one of the subsectors that are in OGIG, one of the eight. So you have all online entertainment. It's going to be a lot less rush back to the movie cinemas, we think. More people are going to be continuing to buy online entertainment, whether they consume it through their phone or through the big screen at home or other ways. That's likely to continue to go. Advertising. All the online advertising trends point up, pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, and in OGIG, you get a lot of the stocks that participate in that revenue growth as well. Food delivery. There's one where people think it might change. People want to go back to restaurants, we think. Maybe not everybody, and maybe not so fast. I think there's a lot of patience you're going to see on like this vaccine rollout. And many people won't actually get the vaccine until the latter part of next year. So who knows on that? But a lot of these delivery services are just one more ingredient of the overall portfolio mix in OGIG. So that's what I would call the revenue growth-related comment. When it comes to valuation, think about this. The price-to-sales ratio is an interesting one to look at. The revenue growth rate of the stocks in OGIG is over 40%. In fact, on a trailing 12-month basis, it's 43%. And the revenue growth rate of the stocks in the NASDAQ 100 index or the traditional tech sector, we call it old tech, that has a lot of the companies that are in hardware and business-to-business software and so on, those revenue growth rates are just a little bit over 10%. So think of that difference. 10% revenue growth compared to 40-plus percent revenue growth. Your business, our business, anyone's business would be much better off with a 40-plus percent revenue growth rate. So we do look at price to sales, and here's what's happened with the price to sales ratio over the last 12 months. It's actually gone up, but it has not gone up by anywhere near as much as the performance of the portfolio. It's gone up by something like 25-30%. So what that really suggests is that the revenue growth rate of these stocks is filling in behind the stock price performance. Maybe not quite 100% keeping up, but it's doing a pretty good job of covering a lot of the ground that the stock price performance has generated. There's one other comment I want to make about the valuation in this sector. A lot of these companies have incredibly high gross margins, really, really high gross margins. And if you just look across the portfolio, you'll see an average gross margin of almost 60%. That's terrific profitability. And it's higher for the mid-sized giants than for the names that you mentioned that many people know, the Amazons, Googles, Alibaba, et cetera.
Connor, you began alluding to this. Can you talk more about the post-COVID world, what you think the economy and markets will look like once we finally put this pandemic behind us? And I guess I'm asking this from more of an investment implications perspective. Like, what should investors be thinking about as we hopefully move away from this, you know, terrific or horrific year of 2020?
Yeah, I think you should be thinking about what things will be go back to being the same the way they were, and what will never go back. And a lot of economists talk about a K-shaped recovery, and just think of the shape of it, the letter K, capital K. There's on the front side, there's one arm that goes up and one arm that goes down. And I think the K-shaped recovery really suggests that some sectors and companies will do really well coming out of this, and others will go to zero or do badly. And that's really what the strategists and economists are thinking of. And so I think one ought to consider quality. And instead of investing in a way that's generic, where you own a mix of everything, all the stocks, those that go up and those that go down, one might want to be more selective and own the higher quality companies. And, of course, I'm talking about something that we do, and it's in our OUSA ETF that's focused on U.S. large caps, high-quality stocks selected for profitability, good balance sheets, and dividend growth. And we found that actually of the dividend cuts that have already occurred year to date, OUSA avoided the majority of them. And if you look at the large cap, any index of 500 large caps, you'll see that about 400 of them used to pay dividends. And you'll see that almost a quarter of those that paid dividends either eliminated or reduced their dividends. Whereas in OUSA, only 5% of the stocks in the portfolio reduced dividends. So that's a much better ratio. And that's just evidence of quality, and it goes back to this K-shaped recovery. The companies that have good businesses will likely recover well. Companies that were struggling pre-pandemic may just be gone post-pandemic. The other thing I think people should think about is this. I mean, this COVID-19 being eliminated by vaccines doesn't mean there won't be something, you know, COVID-20, COVID-2021. We hope not. But I think you know, the health risks globally go up as global viruses can travel so much faster than ever before. So I think investors may want to consider that interest rates are likely to be relatively low, even if there's a bit of inflation that comes back. That's probably good for valuations of stocks in general. You look at the yield spread of dividends as a premium over government bonds, it's almost three times. So it's a very, very strong premium. So that's supportive of equity valuations in general. And then when one's choosing what to own, I think either you choose generic and you live with the losers that go on that lower leg of the K-shaped recovery, or you can look for quality and try to avoid a lot of that lower leg of the K. So that's just a comment on, let's call it, large cap investing. I also think when it comes to technology and old tech versus new tech, the new tech companies are more nimble. They're the ones that generate revenue growth, and ultimately I think most people would expect that revenue growth is a really good indicator of business value growth.
Connor, just a couple minutes left. On the note of tech and OGIG, once we do clear this pandemic, and obviously we have a new administration coming into to office here in the U.S., any thoughts on monopoly concerns. And you noted how OGIG is weighted and it's more diversified. It's not is concentrated at the top. But if we look on the political side with Biden coming into office, do you think big tech could come under more scrutiny here?
It could. That's more of a vote-getting type of discussion than something that's urgent post Jan 20th. I think there's a lot more that's much more urgent than that. And let's see what happens with the Senate. If it ends up being a gridlock D.C., it's going to be even tougher for any of these changes to be pushed through. So these large tech companies are global leaders, and I don't think the U.S. is going to be well served by essentially downsizing its global leaders. But we'll see. Not a huge risk, we don't think. Nevertheless, for OGIG, there are 60-plus companies in here. We don't have the concentration some of these other more traditional indexes have, where they might have so much of the portfolio, as much as half in five or six stocks. We have in OGIG over 60 stocks. So that diversification will help if the scenario you described ends up occurring.
Well, Connor, we're going to have to leave it there. Congratulations on all the success with the ETFs. Again, great having you back on the podcast. Thank you for joining me this week.
Great to be with you, Nate. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
That was Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETFs. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, iShares. You can visit iShares.com to learn more about their investment strategies. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through ETFPrime.com. Next week, I'll be going in-depth on one of the most talked-about topics this year, ESG, sustainable investing. I'll be joined by Sarah Kelberg, U.S. Head of iShares Sustainable ETFs, and Guillermo Cano, Executive Director, Index Solutions Research at MSCI. Until then, have a great week, everyone.